Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear our guest interviewer, Kim McQueen, in conversation with authors John Kalacki and Mark Redmond, whose books are out from Onion River Press. I'm turning this over to Kim now. Have fun.
I'm Kim McQueen, and I first want to thank you, Shayla, again, for inviting me in as a guest interviewer. Periodically, I get to appear on this show. I don't know, I've been doing it for about 6 years, just occasionally when there's a book that I really love. And it gets me the opportunity to just waltz in here to the studio and be on the air talking about books I really love. So I'm here today with John Kalacki and Mark Redmond. Both have published books with Onion River Press in 2021. Kalacki is the author of the book Because Art. Mark Redmond's book is called, it came out in May 2021. Kalacki's book came out in August of 2021. They're both very different, yet similar books. They're kind of, I was just sort of rambling a few minutes ago before we started the show about how they're kind of, for me, they're, I kind of think of the two books as on almost a memoir continuum because, John, your book is a collection of essays written throughout the years, really documenting your career. Called, Mark, is also a it's a similar treatment of a career in service, right? And is sort of written as what we might call a straight memoir. I think during the, were you always friends? You're great friends now. Were you always friends? Did you meet? When did you meet and begin your sort of author friendship?
I think we started off as enemies and we became friends. Is that right, John?
Enemies?
No.
We always loved each other.
I moved here in 2010. Mark was running Spectrum. People kept saying, you got to meet this guy. He's, yeah. And, you know, he's one of my heroes. I love this man. You know, and so what he's done with Spectrum, with kids, you know, homeless kids in Burlington has been extraordinary. His book tells some of those tales. It's he saves lives. I mean, this is a good man. And then I also had the great privilege of serving in the legislature with his wife, Mary Beth Redmond. So I got both of the Redmonds. I got the best of the best.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
Both ends of the deal. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So both of your books came out last year. And since your launches, you've been working almost hand in glove together to promote the books, to make sure they're out there. You've been on any number of different podcasts and interviews together and really mounted just a wonderful just marketing powerhouse, really, for Vermont. I think it's kind of unparalleled in the history of Vermont authorship, possibly, although I might have to check on that. But I do want to spend a bunch of time talking about the ins and outs of how you're marketing your books. But first, I want to talk about how you made each of those books. And I think the best way to do that is something we were talking about a few minutes ago, that John and Mark have traveled together so much for these books that now they've got they've almost got their own dog and pony show going. And I think it's one of the best things that's come out of that is you reading from each other's books. And we're going to take a few minutes to do that now. John, I'd like to ask you to read your favorite section from Called, and then we'll turn the tables on you and Mark will read from your work.
Well, I think we're going to disrupt things a little bit in that way. And what Mark and I did, we did something at the South Burlington Public Library, and we did something at Wake Robin. Mm-hmm. And we decided we would interview each other about our books, and then we would pick a favorite section of each other's book and have that person read it.
Okay.
So my book is a compilation of 56 essays from the 90s to 2021, and a lot of them are about AIDS and disability. But what surprised me is Mark, because he's such a great storyteller, said in my book, the piece that resonated most for him was a piece about Joan Rivers.
Right.
And so I'll read that piece if that's all right, because that's that's the one Mark wanted.
And then, I love that story.
And then Mark can set up how the piece that I asked him to read
book. Yeah, it's there a more intricate performance than I even realized.
Well,
that's cool.
And this would not be the piece that I would think would be the favorite piece of people, but you know,
it resonated with me. This big Joan Rivers fan here, you know.
This was from 2014, and it was done for a commentary for Vermont Public Radio. 2 years ago, I was nervously waiting for Joan Rivers to arrive for rehearsal with local musicians the Flynn had hired as her musical backup. I expected a feral tigress. Instead, I welcomed a kindly grandmother type, chicly dressed in black. She got right down to work. Going through musical cues, the comedian told the band, "I really like you, but when the show starts, I might not be so nice. Don't take it personally." At one point, she explained, "I will fall down and beg you to help me, but don't make a move. It's funnier that way, and I like funny." Local comedian Jason Lorber had been invited to perform a short warm-up set. After his sound check, Rivers told him, "Don't worry if you bomb. The audience is here to see me." Not the most reassuring praise for a fellow artist. After the rehearsal, I handed Miss Rivers her check in an envelope that she immediately opened. "It's the right amount. Thank you," she said with a smile and a wink. This artist knew her finances. Hours later, her raspy, foul-mouthed brilliance came alive on the stage. She began a barrage of insults, telling the old people to leave, attacking the obese, and chiding the lesbians who didn't love her as much as the gays. Nothing was off limits, and the audience at first seemed uncomfortable. Within a few minutes, however, we relaxed, and she goaded us to, "Oh, grow up," and laughed at things no one else would dare talk about in public. This brash, idiosyncratic icon was in top form, demonstrating her lifelong mantra, "Life is tough, so you better laugh at everything." After the performance, she had agreed to do a meet and greet with Flynn supporters. Instructions were precise. Visitors were to stand in line, and Miss Rivers would pose for photographs, and that she did, smiling for each and every photo op until the last person got their memento. 50 years ago, she broke down the male bastion of comedy on mainstream television. Through personal tragedies and professional setbacks, she continually reinvented herself. Daytime talk show host, shopping network maven, celebrity apprentice, reality show star, and red carpet fashionista. "Can we talk?" was always her invitation as she tackled society taboos with irrepressible chutzpah. On her way out of the Flynn that evening, she turned and sweetly said, "Thank you for bringing me to your beautiful theater. Hope you will have me back." Such a fierce comic genius with unstoppable determination. Thank you for all the laughter you allowed us.
That's fantastic.
You can see why I picked that one,
yeah,
right?
Well, tell me what you were thinking when you settled on that as your favorite.
You know, there's so many good chapters in John's book. You know, the one about Christopher Reeve is really good. The one about your own injury and your, you know, what happened to you with your spine, your back, that was good too. But, I mean, I grew up as a kid watching The Tonight Show, you know, and I was in college, and Joan Rivers would occasionally host it, you know. And then she had kind of a second career after that with her daughter. So I just thought it was hysterical just reading like what it's like to have someone meet an icon like that and what she was like in real life, you know. So I just really enjoyed that chapter. I thought it was a great one.
So for Mark's book, of course, his book is stories about redemption and about saving people and also sometimes about relapse and people tripping up. And there is a remarkable relationship that Mark tells in this, in Called, but he also has in his life, of this one particular man, and it, he's known him a long time. So I was very touched by that, by Mark's openness and to hold on to someone. And so that was the piece I would always ask Mark to read.
Okay. There you go. So it's a long chapter, so I'll just take a few pieces from it. So when I was 23 years old, I had a successful job on Madison Avenue in a studio apartment in the Upper East Side, and I, for a variety of reasons, walked away from all that and started working with homeless teenagers at Covenant House. Covenant House is in Times Square. It still is. Times Square today is all Disney, you know, and the Hard Rock Cafe, but in the 1980s, it was a very, very dangerous, rough place. Center of prostitution and pornography, and that's where homeless kids were. So I'll start off, they put me in a floor with a bunch of young teenage men, and I wrote, there was one young man, though, whom I did get to know pretty well, Tony Turner. He was 19, African-American, from Harlem, and from a family with enough difficulties that he ended up homeless. This was a pretty typical story we heard many times at Covenant House. For some reason, Tony and I hit it off right away, even though we had absolutely nothing in common. I was his counselor and would help him look for jobs and talk to him about his problems and goals. He was friendly and funny and had an amiable personality. But the more experienced staff at Covenant House warned me about him. You do realize he's into some bad stuff out there, one of the veteran female staff told me. Be careful of him. He could be dangerous. I had no reason to doubt her. And in fact, shortly after that, I arrived for my shift and found out that Tony had been permanently discharged from Covenant House. The report stated that he had come in high on a street drug by the name of Angel Dust the night before and turned over every piece of furniture in the place. I can't say I was shocked, and I figured that was the last I'd see of Tony. I would be wrong about that. A few months later, I was walking through Times Square on my way to Covenant House, and as usual, there were young men standing in front of strip clubs, handing out flyers, chanting, "Girls, girls, girls, come on in and see the pretty girls." First time I ever heard this, I was shocked, but in time, I just got used to it, which in retrospect is very sad to say. On this particular occasion, I was standing in place on the street corner, waiting for the don't walk sign to change. I heard the usual chant, "Girls, girls, girls," and who would then push a flyer into my chest but Tony. Our eyes locked and he looked absolutely mortified. He tried to hide the flyers behind his back as if it had never happened, and he then attempted a regular conversation. Eventually the walk sign lit up, the others on the corner with me began to cross, and so did I. "Take care, Tony," I said, as I turned and hustled out of there as fast as I could, anxious to quickly end this little interaction. And as I walked away, I could hear him again, "Girls, girls, girls." I figured that was the last I'd see of Tony. I'd be wrong about that, too. 5 years later, I was no longer at Covenant House and was instead attending graduate school at New York University. I'd been invited to a fundraising event in Greenwich Village that someone was holding for a soup kitchen. Many of my Covenant House friends were there too, when I heard a loud voice boom out, "Does anyone here know Tony Turner?" I looked and I saw it was Father Jim Joyce, a priest who had said mass for us at Covenant House. He was a large man, around 300 pounds, so when he yelled, you heard him. "Yeah, we know him," a friend and I yelled back. Father Jim lumbered over and said, "Well, I'm a chaplain at Rikers Island Prison, and I met him, and he said no family members ever go to visit him, but that he used to live at Covenant House, and it would be nice if someone from there would go see him sometime." My friend and I looked at each and said, "We'll go. Before I continue, please keep this in mind. There were 15,000 inmates at Rikers on any given day in the 1980s. What are the chances that this chaplain would meet Tony out of that mass of people and that he'd randomly call out his name at a party and I would hear it? Infinitesimal, I'd say. but it happened. So the rest of the chapter is about me going to visit him in Rikers Island and how shocked he was to see me. And I said, if you give me your address, he said, oh, I've been in drug charges. They're sending me upstate. So I wrote to him, and he would ask me to send him Little Debbie's cupcakes. So I would package up these cupcakes. And this went on. He was in and out of prison, I would say, for a good 15 years. And then later on in the chapter here, I talk about him inviting me to a 12-step meeting. And it was his second anniversary of being clean off of drugs. And he wanted me to be there. So that was 1999, because I remember I met my wife, Mary Beth, right after that. And this December will be Tony's 25th anniversary, being sober from drugs. I got a text from him today. And every 5 years, I go back to New York City to go to the fifth. So it'll be 25 years clean, and I always go. So he's one of my closest. It's kind of it's an incredible story, really. I mean, the chances that shows you about the randomness of life and the capriciousness of life. Well, yeah.
But it also talks about you, Mark, that you hang on to people. And, you know, you're for all your kids, there's a number of stories in your book about people who, you know, fall between the cracks, and you're there. And it's and didn't you go visit Tony like a year ago during COVID? I think there was sometime you and Mary Beth were driving home from somewhere and you stopped to visit him.
We will stop. My wife has met Tony many times. And we will, if we're going to New York City, we will try and stop and see Tony. And this is nice. He, his partner became pregnant and he asked me to go to this chapter about going to the baby shower. And I said it was not exactly a Jack and Jill shower. It was me, Tony, and about 50 women. And, when his wife, a partner, gave birth, he asked me to be the godfather. So I'm the godfather to his daughter, who herself now has grown up and had a daughter of her own. So Tony and I still stay very close and communicate all the time. And he's watched my son Liam grow up. And he came to our wedding when Mary Beth and I got married. He came to our wedding, and I joked in the book. I said, he brought a gift, and there are still relatives, John, who went to that wedding. I'm still waiting for the gift. We've been married 21 years, but Tony brought a gift. So he's really become one of my closest friends.
I wonder, what did he think about you writing about him?
You know, I asked him, I said, is this okay? Because actually, 7 days did a profile of me. And I asked him if he wanted to be in that, and he was okay with that. So Ken Picard did that interview. Mm-hmm. And then I said, I would like to write any young person who's in this book. I cleared it, and if they didn't, I changed their name or whatever. Mm-hmm. But most of them said fine. And he was very, very proud. And when I've met his NA sponsor, he's very proud of it too. He's proud of his story. And, you know, all of us at some point, whether we're addicted to drugs or alcohol or not, I think should go to a 12-step meeting at least once, because the support, it's not just about alcohol and drugs, it's the support they give each other on all fronts of life. You know, and Tony's had trouble raising his daughter as a single parent, and the advice that these men and women give him, you know, it's not just about support to stay sober. It's support about life and all of its problems. So he was, you know, fully in support.
You know, what's great is, I mean, I think you can tell the affection Mark and I have for each other. But, you know, his book is called Called. Yeah. And the first chapter of my book is called Called to Serve.
Yes. Mm.
And I talked about, you know, it's our vocation. Mm-hmm. Mark's vocation is service, and my vocation has been a supportive artist. Mm-hmm. So mine's a lot about a living mosaic of artists from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the decimation of AIDS and disability. But I talk about the Latin word vocare, vocation is based
That's
on,
right.
means to be called. And so it's been really fun to see mm-hmm. our vocations on parallel tracks mm-hmm. In this journey. And, you know, I think we also struggled with, you know, the hybrid publishing world with Onion River books that we're both on, and we're very happy there. But then it was up to us to promote. And I think we both were of the mindset that, you know, we put a lot of work into these books, and you know, mine is representing 30 years, and it's Mark's career too. So we really committed to, okay, it's up to us to now promote the books. And it was during COVID, so it was an interesting time to figure out what to do. And, mm-hmm. you know, we did some joint events together, but we also urged each other on with mm-hmm. generosity and gave each other ideas. And that was really helpful.
Were you involved in each other's production or, not really production, but editorial? Did you give each other notes, or was the first time you saw each other's books when they were published?
First time when they were published, okay. Right? I mean, I don't know what you, I'm sure you did. I gave, this went through many drafts. I gave it to a lot of people, read it, comment, edit it, line edit, you know. So John was not one of those people. But I'm sure you did that. But yours were already columns that were published, right,
well,
John?
They were, but they were from the 90s on with different publications. So right. What I had to do is standardize them to mm-hmm. one kind of style. Mm-hmm. So I did have four copy editors mm-hmm. working with me to help with that. Right. But I also used Mark's designer. He said, here's a really good person. And because I had no idea what I was getting into. You know, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. And it's like, okay, I did this part. Oh, I have to do this. Now I have to do this. Now, you know, it's, and so it was a big journey. And, you know, I think as anyone gets into this publishing, you have to really set your goals because, you know, as artists, we have two jobs, to make work and then to put it out in the world.
Right. That's right. Right.
And a lot of artists in all disciplines stop at making the work. And it's just been great to work with Mark because we just, you know, have supported each other.
Yeah.
We also believe in the work.
Right. So I also want to highlight what you said about four copy editors and a paid designer that John, you weren't even didn't even know this person. This was someone. This is a professional who Mark put you in touch with. So when you're bringing a book to the marketplace, it's not a failure that as soon as you get a final draft that you love, you really have to turn it over to me, 5 to 10 other professionals to make sure it has the attention it needs before you actually have it up for sale. Four copy editors is like, there. I can think of a lot of authors who might be really daunted by that, and after edit, maybe copy edit number three, say, oh, wait a minute, I must be missing something. And it's not that you're missing anything, it's that you really need those four people. And I'm sure that you gleaned something from each one of them that helped make the book stronger, but you had to have all four.
And my grammar was extensively improved with each of them, which I am very grateful for.
So how many, so for both of you, how long from idea to finished book?
It's a while. It's a project. So a lot of my stories I told at The Moth. I've been telling stories for The Moth really since 2013. The first story I ever told was on stage at the Flynn. Uh-huh. I had left a 2-minute message for The Moth, and 6 months later they emailed me and said, hey, we got your 2-minute message and we're coming to the Flynn Theater for the first time ever. Call us. We want to hear your story. So I was shocked, and I ended up on stage. So then I told other stories for The Moth and other storytelling podcasts, and so many people kept saying to me, when are we going to see this in book form? When are we going to see this in book form? So after like the 10th person said that, I was like, okay, I've got to put these in book form. However, it's like what you said. You just don't take what you said on stage and put a verbatim right into a book. It's right. A totally different format. So the guts of the story may be in there, but it takes a lot of work. So it was months and months and months, and then sending it out for other people to read, and then the cover, and then the design of the, I never thought of the design of the interior,
that's
right?
Hard. Yeah.
I was like, it's words. The designer was like, no, there's a, how you format it and where the pictures go, that there's a lot to publish. And then you didn't do this, I did it. I did an audio version also.
Yeah.
So I've got that too, and so that was also, that was a lot of time.
Let's talk about that though for a second. Tell me about your experience recording the book. Did you actually record it in your voice?
So I recorded it.
Of course
it in
he
my
did.
Voice.
He's a storyteller. Redmond wouldn't let anyone else tell that. If I tried to do his voice over, no. Yeah. He's a storyteller. Redmond had to do it.
Well, it was funny. There are people in Vermont who do this well professionally for you, yes. And I priced them out, and it was a lot of money. So then I Googled how to record your own book, you know, and I got help from someone who does this for a living, but it was much cheaper. But I literally went in my son's room. I stuck towels underneath. I waited for when the F-35s would go past. And I got a good microphone like this. Yeah. And I used my son's Mac and I recorded it. But then I had to send it to this fellow. And then he sent back all the correct, you know, read this over, do this over, you know, this is missing, you missed this word or whatever. So that was hours and hours and hours of work too to record it. I still debate, that has not sold well at all. There's a few people who have, I don't know, I thought audiobooks would be more popular than they are. I keep hearing audiobooks are really popular, they're outpacing ebooks now. Mm-hmm. But at least in my case, that wasn't true. But who knows? I'm glad I did it. I know there are people who listen to it and enjoyed the book that way.
Sure. Was it fun? So it doesn't sound like it was a whole lot of fun for you to record, or was it?
It was fun because I like to hear myself.
Yeah.
I like to hear myself speak, John. And you have the headphones on while you're doing
it. But you're also a theater guy. You like to really have the spoken word. So I'm glad you did the audiobook. I think it's part of you.
There's something really magical about your book in your own voice, in the author's voice.
People have said that to me. Especially I have the Long Island accent. So it was very authentic.
You know, for me, I started in January and I've been very lucky. I've had like 300 somethings published and I just thought, is there something here to put together? And I didn't know what it was going to be, so I just started going through files and stuff. And the book changed shapes a number of times. At first I thought it'd be some kind of linear thing, and then I thought it'd be thematic. But in the end, the first grouping is commentaries I've written, mm-hmm. And then the second part are reviews of artists that I've worked with. And I think that has been powerful for people because it's a lot of queer artists that have died from AIDS and people don't really know who they are. So people were like, well, these are, you know, people that I hope I can add to the history book about some of them.
Yes.
And then the third part are interviews I've did with people like Alison Bechdel and Tony Kushner that I've been able to do in public, and I had transcripts of those. So after about 3 or 4 months of shifting things around, the book took its form, but I wasn't sure what the form was going to be when I started the process.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask a question I don't think I prepared you all for. I want to know, because I sense that I sense you're ready. If you were to have the ability to talk to a first-time author and really give them the lowdown about what's the most important thing to know to plan for after your book is published.
For after your book is published.
After. Because I, as John mentioned, it came up again, it came up a lot actually at our first annual Green Mountain Book Festival, which was this weekend. We had a great publishing panel led by Bill Schubart. Famous.
Sure.
It was a really fantastic panel. Dee Dee Cummings was there from Green Writers Press. In this conversation, I feel like we are dancing up to really what should be a prescription for a first-time author. just the idea, and this came up again and again in the publishing panel. Marketing is about the most important thing after the creation itself of the book. And we had a couple questions on the publishing panel, and I had the same kind of question bubbling up in me, which is, yeah, but how? How do you do that? How okay, do you plan to do something you've never done?
I was at your wonderful festival for that panel in the audience, and it was terrific. It really was. But one author raised her hand and asked a question, and she said, yeah, I finished my book, and it's nonfiction. I'm really excited about it, but, you know, I don't know. I guess I should start a Facebook page or something. And I just, my heart sank. Because here, Mark and I are a year after our book is published, and we're still talking about it. Mm. And we're still trying to figure out different ways to promote it.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to go up to that author and said, this is really important to you that you've done this book. And now you have to dedicate the next year to promote the book because, you know, it's your other job as an artist.
Yes.
And, you know, we've... people joke, they say, oh, we watch you to promote, but it's like, well, Mark's, that's a really important book to him, and yeah. This is an important book for me. It's a compilation of my life's work, and so why wouldn't I want to promote it,
yeah.
You know? And so, I don't know, how would you answer that?
The advice I got is, even if you're with a really established house like Harcourt Brace, it's up to you to promote it. That age where the, you know, unless you're Chris Bajalian or somebody like that, you know, it's up to you. These houses are not really going to spend much time or money. It is up to you to be very aggressive. Mm-hmm. And people said to me, like we're on now, podcasts are one of the main ways. Myself, how many times have I listened to a podcast, heard an author, and ordered that book, mm-hmm. You know? So podcasts are important.
An amazing thing Mark said to me, John, there's this really interesting podcast called This Is Actually Happening. Is that the
That's
title?
It. That's it. That's
and
the
he
name.
Said, you know, and it's the whole premise of this is there's a juncture in someone's life that's completely disruptive and it's a complete pivot point. Mm-hmm. And 26 years ago, I was paralyzed from the neck down after surgery. And I write about that in the book. He said, you tell them about that. Mm-hmm. And so I sent in my little paragraph about this. You sent him a copy of the book. They interviewed me, and it aired. And it's been amazing. 220,000 people listen to this podcast each week. And it's a narrative podcast, so the guy interviewed me for like 6 hours, but he's completely out of it. So you only get the person speaking before the event, of the event, and then after the event, and how your life has changed and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just linked to my website, and I've gotten emails, and I was on a conference call in Australia about it, and it's just people are sharing things about their own issues around paralysis or disability or autism or different things. And of course, it did help sell the book, mm-hmm. which is important. So you know, but it's a way that we work with each other. It's like, this is a good idea. Mark's also been interviewed for that podcast, so he should be up next. And
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. Although, again, someone had said to me who would look at your book and try and see, because podcasts are listed by genre, you know, what genres does yours fit in, you know? So I saw that one, This Is Actually Happening, and there's a harrowing chapter in here about how I almost got killed by a bunch of thugs in Brooklyn when I took over a shelter for homeless teenagers. And then it clicked. I like, John's got a great chapter in there about being paralyzed, you know? And I said, John, why don't you, it's all about pitching. So I'm on another podcast. I don't even know if you know this, John. I think it's next week, called Family Secrets. And that's a very popular podcast, too. And there's a chapter in my book about when I went through a very, very serious depression after I got divorced and never told anybody after it was through. And when I wrote the book, I decided I'm going to include that. So I pitched them. I sent a little blurb or whatever, and boom, it's going to be on. So it's constantly thinking, what are the – and your book covers a lot of different facets – like some of mine does.
I pitched queer things. I've pitched disability things. I pitched avant-garde. I pitched, you know, AIDS certainly is a big issue. But I think that's the part of, as an author has to almost dissect all the different aspects, even if it's just fiction, about what is this address and what in your life are the different things that can work on it. And it's almost like you have to pretend it's not you.
Mm. Absolutely.
It's like it's a brand, or it's in a way I can be effusive about Mark, right? Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me then to pitch my own self.
Absolutely, that's
but
true.
I have to say, our media here in Vermont is so open. Mm-hmm. People, all the radio stations are interested in us. Most of the online and print publications are interested in us, but we have to let them know about it. And, you know, but that's also costly if you're doing this kind of self-publishing.
It is.
You know, I probably had to distribute close to 100 books. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got then press in Minnesota and in California. But it didn't occur to me as I was putting my budget together that I'd have to do that as well. But that's what a publicist does. So you have to immediately turn to do that.
Mm-hmm. Put on the publicist's hat.
Yeah.
You know, so to speak. Yeah, it occurs to me while we're talking that this publicity and marketing that so many first-time authors find really daunting, you both seem to find a really natural part of this original calling, you know, if that makes sense. You're frowning, Mark, I don't know.
No. It came now. I mean, first of all, it costs money. Okay, so I'm gonna be very like, I went to my wife and said, "Here's the budget, you know, to hire somebody to make a nice cover, a website to record it. You know, it's several thousand dollars, and I think I can sell enough books to earn it back."
Right.
So that's, you know,
you never really know.
You don't know. You're taking a gamble.
Absolutely.
There. So I'm still pushing, you know, my where I went to college. This is nice, John. You don't even know this. I went to Villanova University.
I know. I still follow you on social media. You're performing at Villanova.
I'm performing. Villanova invited me
just
back.
Just come out and say it.
And he'll just have copies of that book with him.
And
okay?
I'm hoping, you know, they're going to be so wowed and say, gee, all the freshmen next year have to buy it. Copy of Gold and read it. That would be nice. But I mean, you have to. I mean, I want to earn the money back. And then I feel passionate about the book like John does about his and the stories in it. I think it's adding to humanity. It's adding to society, you know?
And when it's as, I think both of your books are beautifully designed and laid out. And I felt so silly. I had two self-published books. And I would always sort of plan for marketing and have these, you know, have just a blank thoughts. I had no real plans, and I wasn't sure how to go about it. And then the book came out, and it was an actual physical object. And I thought, oh, this speaks for itself. All I really need to do is introduce me to the people who I want to make friends with as my readers. And then all I really need to do is just be myself and put as many copies of my book into people's hands as they will allow.
Right.
There's so many people doing so many crazy social media things, anything from just going nuts on Facebook and Twitter and, you know, focusing all their effort there. When really, if you could just sort of plan a social media strategy or a marketing strategy as part of it.
Sometimes those bully pulpits of one are deceiving for all of us. You know, we had the other thing that we couldn't really do a lot of in-person things because of when these books came out, it was COVID.
Right.
But, you know, I called librarians where I'd done speeches before and asked them if they buy one. All of my friends who are teaching at universities across the country, I asked them as faculty members if they would buy one for their library. It doesn't cost them anything. And so they did, but it seemed bizarre. But you know, it was you have to do that.
I don't want to blow past how smart it is for you to just order 100 copies of your book and just give them out, just put them into people's hands.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, it's expensive, but
yeah, Bill Schulbart told me that early on. Yeah. You're going to need at least 50 copies. Yeah. You know what's the number one site, though? This sounds crazy, but New York Times had a long article about 3 months ago. I might have sent it to you. TikTok.
Yes.
TikTok is the number one site for selling books right now. Somebody will put it on TikTok. I'm not even on TikTok. I don't know how to use TikTok.
My kids won't let me on TikTok.
But that is like, it's called TikTok Book or something like that. Mm-hmm. If you get your book on TikTok and people start spreading it, so maybe somebody at Villanova, I'm sure a lot of those Villanova kids are on TikTok, mm-hmm. and I'm going to ask them. But that is an influential way.
So you're doing this Villanova talk mm-hmm. Solo.
Yeah, so I did this is a cute story. So, you know, the moth, right? I left a 2-minute voicemail message in 2013, 1-800 the moth. They call me back 6 months later. Next thing I know, I'm on stage at the Flynn. And next thing I know, I'm on stage in Montreal. Then I'm in Brooklyn and I'm in Boston. And then somebody at the moth said to me, you know, there's this one person festival on Broadway. Once it's international, it's really competitive. You have to apply for it. You should apply. I applied and I got picked. So I had my own one person show on Broadway right around the corner from Covenant House. It was literally a theater I had walked by 1,000 times in the 1980s. So then I went back to the people at the Flynn and said, hey, listen, if I was good enough for a one-person show on Broadway, I think I'm good enough for a one-person show at the Flynn.
Oh, now, wait a minute. That's been visionary. No, we invited you first before you did the Broadway show. And you were so stubborn, you decided you were going to do two different shows.
I did.
The one you're doing in New York.
Why?
No, he couldn't do that. He had to do special. I don't know why. That's Mark.
I wanted a little bit different. And so So that's what I'm doing in Villanova. They have a beautiful new theater that they just built, and they contacted me. They heard about me, and so I'll speak at some classes, and then I have a show Thursday night from 7 o'clock to 8:15. Oh, so yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, I'm doing a Montpelier has an art walk, and one of my films is going to be projected outdoors during the art walk. Wonderful. But at the opening reception, of course I'm going to have copies of the book.
Yes, yes, yes.
You always have to carry a bunch of books in your car just in case there's an opportunity.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's definitely true. Hey, I want to talk about the cover a bit. So the cover, picking a cover was tricky, and my wife said to me, why don't you call Lisa Cadieu? She does all the materials for Spectrum, but like brochures and mm-hmm. things like that. And she said, maybe she knows something about book design. So I called Lisa or emailed her, and she said, I just took a course at RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, on book design. I just finished the course. That's my new passion. That's the area I want to get into. So I hired Lisa, and she came up with like 4 prototypes. And I walked into Phoenix Books in downtown Burlington and put the 4 different versions on the desk there. And the entire place, customers, staff, everybody dropped what they were doing. And they were like, that's the one. No, that one. No, this one looks too much. And ultimately, they came down with this cover. I didn't really pick this cover. It was like crowdfunding or how hive mind or whatever term you want to use.
So that's the secret to picking your covers, commandeer your local bookstore.
That's what I did. And I think it worked quite well. So, and then I told you about, you're right, I told you, hey, Lisa really does a good job. So that's how
it. But I was like, Mark's cover is really lovely, but it was not anywhere near what I was thinking about. And so when I met with Lisa, I said, okay, Donald Judd was a minimal sculptor. There's just been a book released of his writing. I said, I really like that, but it's very different than Mark's. It's really simple. And she said, well, show me. So I showed her the Donald Judd thing. And so she worked up 3 different things. And I'm so happy I worked with her. The book is so elegant and it's so beautiful.
It
and
is.
The colors, she chose colors that I never would have chosen. And it became so much bigger and better because of her. So Bill Schubart said this at your festival, Kim, that authors have to let designers design.
Absolutely.
And you have to allow that because that's part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be difficult to find artist to work on your book.
Well, Lisa's the one. I recommend her. Buy local, buy Lisa.
Yeah,
right, John?
Great.
She's right here in Burlington.
Yeah, there's actually a number of folks in Vermont that have done really good work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some beautiful, beautiful books coming out of, Onion River Press, actually.
We love Onion River Press. No, they were great. They were great to work with, start to finish. They really were.
So, are there other book projects on the horizon for either one of you?
I don't have any. I mean, I've got to sell this thing first. Although my website, it's funny, when I did a website, the woman said, call it Mark Redman Book. No, Mark Redman Books, because this will be, you'll have more. And I actually had a different book published in 2004 by Paul's Press. Mm-hmm. So I have more than one book out there. Mm-hmm. So I don't have anything in the offing, but how about you, John?
No, 2004, I edited an anthology called Queer Crips, Disabled Gay Men and Their Stories on Rutledge. And that was an interesting experience because the gay presses rejected it.
Really?
It wasn't the buff boys and the lipstick lesbians.
Yeah.
And the disability presses rejected it because it was like this wasn't the inspiration porn of happy, adjusted people with disabilities. But it came out and it's continues in print today because it's in queer studies programs, mm-hmm. disability studies programs that won a Lambda Literary Award. But it came out with Rutledge. I did one book reading, that's all. I didn't do anything with it. Mm-hmm. That was back then. And so it's different when we're in this hybrid world of the self-publishing with like an Onion River, where it's really the onus is on us to mm-hmm. continue it. And the success of this book has also added a demand for the other book.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
It's allowed it to have its own life, a much longer life than I ever imagined. But no more books for me.
I'm trying to convince my wife, Mary Beth, to write a book. In fact, one who John knows well, they served together in the legislature. And she had a book published years ago. She started a writing but worked with a woman to do a writing program
Incredible
for women
book.
In prison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And had Hear Me, See Me, which was published by Orbis Press. Beautiful book. And that was an incredible book reading because the women actually came out of prison that day. And we're at Main Street Landing and read their passages from the book. It was really amazing.
That sounds
beautiful. It was like, you know, it was amazing. So one of my neighbors said to Mary Beth, when do I see your book, Mary Beth? And I said to her, that's a sign. That's a sign when people start saying to you. Because that was just one thing that she's done. You know, her work in the legislature, the work she did with you. So I'm encouraging her. She's the next member of the family to write a book.
I'm actually, next month, I have the finance together, shooting my 17th film.
Nice.
So I got it all set up. I have my production team, and I'm the Fluxus Art Movement from the 60s. That'll be another whole program talking about Fluxus. Yoko Ono was a Fluxus artist.
Is that right?
Go ahead and say a little bit more about it now.
Well, it was an idea of these artists who, like, Yoko, with her ideas, was much more important than the object.
Right.
Lamont Young did a score called Draw a Line and Follow It. Mm-hmm. That's all he did. Mm-hmm. Namjoon Paik was in a gallery. He dipped his head in ink and rolled across the floor, and that was Lamont Young's score. So I'm taking these scores, and I'm redoing them myself. So it's kind of a... No one will know the Fluxus. I mean, I'll certainly recognize all of the artists who inspired me from it, but it's just... My next little piece.
Yeah. There will probably be a lot of opportunity to do a lot of writing around that to introduce it once you've made it.
Well, when I was doing the research, someone said to me, "Oh, there's an old Fluxus artist that lives in Brattleboro." So I went down there and I wrote an essay in 7 days about Nye Faribas, who turned 90. And just sitting with her for hours, interviewing her was glorious. because she and Yoko would raise their kids together. So they'd sit there as moms in the park talking about their kids and about trying to make work as women. And
so that's
great stories from Nye.
Books, films like that, they just are so important for our legacy.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, Kim, how about you? Are you? What's your next book?
I am working on a memoir, but as is my way, I'm also working on two or three other things, and one of those was the book festival that has just concluded for this year. We're already starting to talk about ideas for next year for that. I have taken over as editor and publisher of Ann River Press, and we'll spend the next few months just getting up to speed with that and welcoming new authors to the press. And then, when time allows a little bit, probably at the end of October, I'm hoping to get a few weeks to really focus on my memoir, make it my full-time job. It's called Snowbirds, and it starts with the story of my grandparents who both grew up in Little Italy in Manhattan. It's very, 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 very fun to write. And as soon as I sit down to work on it, I am immediately reminded of all I don't know and all I really have yet to learn to go and find out about my grandparents and my great-grandparents and what life was like for Italian immigrants in the 1920s in Manhattan, which is a really interesting story. And more I'm realizing that talks like this, where I'm able to talk to you and Mark about the parts of yourselves that you bring not only to making your work, but to selling your work and promoting your work and getting it really out there into the world and introducing it to everyone. The way I think to do that is to start with the facts, start with your life, start with what sort of keeps you up at night and what you write about because you can't shut up about it, and how to turn that into one's life story. It's something I really am going to be working on, I think, for the rest of my life. You know, not working on just my own book, but working with people like you to bring their own stories.
Well, out. I'm not going to let you forget that menu idea you had of the cookbook.
That is actually... here's what I'll say about that, John. It's September and Christmas is in December, and you will be hearing from me because I promised you that Italian cookbook in 2014, and it is one of those recipes that takes a long time.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
So, I think that's the joy of knowing both of you is over a long term, and both of you as artists I admire a great deal.
Oh, same here.
Same here.
Same here. Same here. Thank you all.
Thank you.
So that was really fun to just be a listener. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to our guest interviewer, Kim McQueen, in conversation with authors John Kalacki and Mark Redmond. I want to just mention Kim McQueen is the... What's your official title?
At Onion River Press. I'm editor and publisher.
Editor and publisher at Onion River Press. She's written two novels, People Who Hate America and Out Out, a novel of women and apes. Her stories and essays have been featured in The Inquisitive Eater, The Southeast Review, Creative Loafing Atlanta, Wisdom Daily, and others. So the Green Mountain Book Festival was this weekend, and it was a great event in Burlington, Vermont. Woohoo! And I'm on the board, and Kim's on the board. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider what panel about books you would most love to attend, and then let me know. Because as a board member, I'm going to be looking for fresh ideas next year. Thank you for that. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Susan Mills is going to be at the Norwich Bookstore on Wednesday, September 28th at 7 with On the Wings of a Hummingbird, her new novel. Blyden B. Jackson Jr.'s posthumously released novel, For One Day of Freedom, is going to be online with the Rokeby Museum, hosting a panel of experts and Jackson's loved ones to discuss the late author and activist's life and work. That's Thursday, September 29th at 6:30. Let's see. Middlebury College is going to host Where We Land Fall Festival. Jason Reynolds. The celebrated author reminisces about working with Ibram X. Kendi on the young adult anti-racism primer Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You. That's Monday, October 3rd at 7. Boy, there's a few things next Monday. There's the Storykeepers Workshop, Celebrating Family History at the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, Monday, October 3rd at 10 a.m. Jodi Picoult and Jennifer Finney Boylan will be online with Northshire Bookstore and Random House Publishing, Monday, October 3rd at 8. I think you can get more information at northshire.com. I would love your feedback about Write the Book. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell all your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. I'm slowing down now. We have 2.5 minutes, and I've got a minute of music. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com, which, as I say every week, is just a mnemonic for how to spell my name. It's not as unfriendly as it sounds. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week. And give me 1 second, I'll get my music going. Hold on. You guys can have 30 seconds to say something. Do you want to say anything?
Well, I was an audience member of your festival that the two of you put on, and it's a volunteer board that put this on, and it was a great event for Burlington and all the authors that were supported and all of the different panels and seeing everybody signing their books and people in Fletcher Library just having a great time. It was incredible, and you sold out Contois. So it was good.
It was a wonderful event. And I should say the Media Factory was one of our sponsors, along with many others that we are really grateful for. But thank you for saying that. Very nice thing, John.
The first. we're going to say it's the first because you're doing it again.
We are. Yeah. We are. So I am putting my music on and have a great week, everybody.